So the material that's being handed out, like I've said before, is to be used as a study guide. There will be times where we dip into and answer questions out of there, but it is a great study guide for studying the Corinthian letter. I will be out, let's see, this Sunday, I will be out in a couple weeks, so I won't be teaching chapters 9, 10, and the beginning of chapter 11. And so go ahead and make sure you do those, because I would assume that you're going to stick a little more closely to the material, correct? Who knows? I got in early and I get in often with the idea that I'm not sticking with material. You should have done that a long time ago. So, so I'll be here. We're leaving on the 18th. So I've got Sunday, Wednesday, something like that. I don't know. Well, we're covering the rest of 7 and all of 8. And then I think Grandpa will be taking over for three classes. So, yes. So I would say chapters 9, 10, and 11, you'll probably follow that material a little more closely, but that is to his discretion. So we'll begin in chapter 7 this morning, but before we begin, I've asked Doug if he would lead us in a word of prayer. All right, so 1 Corinthians 7, we're going to cover the first 16 verses this morning, and that's the intention. We're coming through to a shift in the letter that Paul has written to the Corinthian brethren. Up until this point, Paul has been dealing with things that have been reported to him. And so he's been dealing with the idea of misplaced faith and dealing with people exalting messengers or listening to the wisdom of men versus the wisdom of God. We've also dealt with this idea of immorality that's in and amongst them and how they should have been dealing with it. And then the idea of bringing others unto judgment through the unrighteous versus the righteous. And then we dealt with, at the end of chapter 6, this idea of Gnosticism and the body is nothing, and that you can do whatever you want to the body because it's nothing compared to spiritual. Then we move into chapter 7, and now chapter 7, there's a shift. In chapter 7, verse 1, it says, "Now concerning the things which you wrote." And so from here forward, we're going to be dealing with the things that they wrote Paul about. So you've got the things that were reported about, were questions. And so Paul is going to shift focus from what he has been discussing. And now he's going to be dealing with these things. Now, it's interesting to me, and I put coincidence or not, is that Paul starts 5, and in chapter 6, we've talked about immorality, fornication. And so for anybody who, those aren't words that we use on a daily basis. We don't go out in the world and say somebody's committing immorality or fornication. That is the unlawful sexual relationship, glorious thing. So sexual relationship is condoned by God. And it's a fornication or immorality. We're talking about an unlawful sexual relationship between two people who aren't married. When we say adultery, we're talking about someone else. So to clarify, because we're going to move into chapter 7, and maybe I should have clarified that before, but amongst you, what's going on here? Now, it's interesting that up until this point, he's been talking about the immorality amongst you, can use it for immorality. And then he moves into this idea of, this immorality, but for the relationship between a husband and a wife. So you see in 6:13, it says the body is not for immorality, but for verse 1, it says, "Now concerning the things about which you wrote, it is good for a man not to touch a woman, but because of immoralities, each man is to have his own wife and each woman is to have her own husband." This is a good way, a good opportunity for Paul to address this idea of immorality and discuss what had been or expressed to him maybe as a concern about the husband and wife relationship and that sexual relationship between them. So you read on in verse 3. It says, "The husband must fulfill his duty to his wife, and likewise also the wife to her husband. The wife does not have authority over her own body, but the husband does. And likewise also the husband does not have the authority over his own body, but the wife does. Stop depriving one another, except by agreement for a time, so that you may devote yourselves to prayer and come together again, so that Satan will not tempt you because of your lack of self-control." Down in verse 9 it says, "But if they do not have self-control, let them marry, for it is better to marry than to burn with passion." So this idea of a sexual relationship, God created us male and female, and the wife is to be a companion to the husband. But a part of that companionship and a part of marriage comes this act of sex. Okay, and so a part of that is we see that when two come together, they become one flesh. You have passions right here in verse 9. It says, it's better to marry. I do want to express, and it is something that is innate within us, that way God created us. Now, what I do want to express, if I say to the unmarried and to widows who had been in that type of relationship where there was a sexual relationship with a spouse, that passion may be. There is this understanding that you have passion within you, and especially after you've been married, that passion. This is not condoning going out because of verse 9 is not condoning, or anywhere in here condoning, well, let me go and because of him, because I have this passion within me. You know, verse 2 talks about that's not the point of marriage. We can control ourselves, but we see the flip side of this, which is that withheld that of that type of relationship when you're in, once you're into it, or once you've withheld. Talk about if you flip over to Matthew chapter 5. It's not the one I want. I want Matthew 19. Oh, no. I was right. Changed my mind again. Matthew 5, I'll start in verse 31. We'll read verse 31 and verse 32. This is Jesus dealing with this idea of divorce. It says, it was said, whoever sends his wife away, let him give her a certificate of divorce. Matthew 5:32. But I say to you that everyone who divorces his wife except for the reason of unchastity makes her commit adultery. All right. When you divorce your spouse for a reason other than adultery, why is it that you cause them to commit adultery? The idea that I think of, and Craig expressed it great, is complicitness. You leave somebody in a situation where you're depriving them or you've moved on from that relationship. They may want or need to fulfill that passion that they have. Are they responsible? Yes. But you are complicit in that action because you divorced them for a reason other than adultery. You are complicit. That's what it's talking about here. You caused them to commit adultery. So that's if they, and there's more to it. I'm just bringing it up from the standpoint of what we're dealing with here. So back to 1 Corinthians 7. What we need to understand here is this is a duty based on a relationship. So if you hadn't heard that once, you hadn't heard it 1,000 times. But there are those in this congregation who may not have heard it. And so I want to bring it up now. This is not a foreign concept. We see it here, and it's pretty plain in this context, but we see these duties based on relationships throughout the Bible based on the type of relationship you sustain one to another. So give me a relationship that you have duties based on that. Parent-child relationship. Children to obey their parents. Fathers aren't to provoke their children to wrath. Parents have a responsibility to take care of their kids. That is, it's not somebody else's kids. I mean, Lisa may want me to take care of Elliot, but that's not my responsibility. I'd love for somebody else to take care of Aurora and Sean from at least the financial standpoint. They'll each out a house and home, but it's my responsibility. All right, what's another relationship that we see this? Okay, so going the other direction, children to parents. I was thinking younger but older. We have a responsibility as adults to take care of our elderly parents when the time comes. What else? Employer-employee, you can go continue on in Ephesians 6 and talks about the slave-master relationship, which can be applied to the employer-employee relationship. You have a duty based on your relationship to that company. So Chevron's not going to call me up and say, hey, why didn't you show up today and work? I don't work for you, but I'm an employee for somebody, but I'm not an employee for Chevron. So I have no responsibility to Chevron for that reason. So what's another one? Citizen to a government. That's another one. Okay, so I don't know. I'm not going to get a call from, England and say, well, hey, you're driving on the wrong side of the road. Or, hey, you need to take, I'm not under their purview until I'm there in their country. And I am subject to their laws because I'm there visiting in their country. But I have no duty or responsibility to them to pay their taxes or do anything else because I'm not a citizen of their country. Give me another one. Okay, there's two that I'm thinking of, and I have all these written down, so they're great. But the neighbor-to-neighbor relationship, okay? You have a duty based on your relationship to another individual, okay, to have a caring love for them, all right? That's the second greatest command, love your neighbor as yourself. So you have a duty of responsibility. So outside of my relationship to Christ, it is innate within us that we have a responsibility to help our neighbor. And what I don't mean is you need to pay all their bills and everything, but you think of the Good Samaritan, all right? The neighbor love that he showed, the fact that he went and helped the man who was on the side of the road. He took him. He put him up into a hotel. He cared for him. He valued him. He showed respect for that person. We have that responsibility. He didn't do it based on his relationship to God because he's a Samaritan. He did it because it's the duty he had based on his relationship to his neighbor. What's another one? Our relationship with God, we have a duty based on our relationship to God. That's another big one. We've already kind of talked about that a little bit when it comes to the idea of withdrawing from somebody. And we're going to deal with it again when it comes up, when it talks about worship, specifically the Lord's Supper in chapter 11. That's another one. Somebody who doesn't sustain a relationship to God isn't going to observe the Lord's Supper or isn't going to worship in that way. It doesn't mean they won't, but it's my duty based on my relationship to God that I do so. Brother, sister,
in Christ.
Okay, so in Christ. And that's the other one I was thinking about as well. We have a duty based on our relationship to one another. Okay, that's kind of the idea of, not kind of, that is the idea in chapter 5. That I have a duty based on my relationship to any one of you to encourage, to uplift, to hold you accountable, to try to strengthen, and you have the same responsibility to me. That also means discipline when the time comes. There's a lot of things. Okay, Romans chapter 12 talks about showing preferential treatment to your brethren. And so we have duties based on these relationships. Okay, specific to, now this is where this comes in handy, is the fact that this is husbands to wives, but it's not any husband to any wife. So Ephesians chapter 5, you don't necessarily have to turn over there, I think y'all would all know this, but Ephesians chapter 5 says, husbands, love your wives. That doesn't mean I'm supposed to love Amy, or it doesn't mean I'm supposed to love Lisa, or I'm supposed to love somebody else. They're not my wife. It's based on my relationship. And I think that's clearly understood when it comes to the husband-wife relationship, but we lose it sometimes when we talk about it specific to the other relationships we sustain. Yes, ma'am. Oh, I agree. So, question. How many relationships do you see in chapter 7, verse 2 through 5? How many relationships do y'all see? D Deanna, you can say it. The three. I think you're correct. I think there's three. So what are the three you think of, Deanna? Husband, wife, brother, sister, Christian God. Oh, so there's another one. There's four then. She did three, but there's four. I missed one. See, I'm fallible. So you've got your husband wife relationship, your brother to sister in Christ, your neighbor to neighbor relationship, and then you've got their relationship, each one as a Christian, to God and their responsibility to Him. Why I bring that up is because as you deal with the sexual relationship, it's not just transactional. So we'll get to that in just a second. I want to focus specifically based on this idea of it's a duty based on relationship. And then we're going to get to the fact that this is not just a transactional relationship. So when you get married, the two become one flesh. All right. You are united. And in doing so, when you make that commitment, you're giving yourself over to your spouse and they're giving themselves over to you. So Paul is dealing with this idea that husbands must fulfill his duty to his wife. They're dealing with an issue, which is verse 5. Stop depriving one another except for agreement for a time. Why they were depriving each other, I don't know. And was that causing some of this immorality where they were fulfilling these desires that they had outside of their marriage relationship through the idol worship with the prostitutes at the temple or whatnot. But what we see is it is a duty that you are to fulfill to your wife and a duty that she has to fulfill to you. So it says in verse 4, the wife does not have authority over her own body. And we see the not but idiom here. So does she have authority over her own body? Yes, but we're emphasizing that the husband does because of this relationship. And likewise, also the husband does not have authority over his own body, but the wife does. We have that stability when we get married. Okay, but again, I want to go back to the relationships that are spoken of in this context. It's not a transactional thing. Well, we're married, so you owe me. And so we just need to go and do this, and that's the way this is going to be. No, it's not just a matter of the husband-wife relationship, and it's a transactional thing, the sexual relationship. I want it, you need to give it to me. It's also governed by the idea of this caring love, which is this love that you have for a neighbor. So look over at Ephesians chapter 5. Well, now we all want you to flip over there. Verse 22, it says, wives, be subject to your own husbands as to the Lord. For the husband is head of the wife, as Christ also is the head of the church, and he himself being the Savior of the body. But as the church is subject to Christ, so also the wives ought to be to their husbands in everything. Okay, so anytime a wife demands that he wants this type of relationship, then she must be obedient to that, right? No, keep reading. This relationship is governed by caring love. Husbands, love your wives, just as Christ also loved the church and gave himself up for her. Go down to verse 28. So husbands ought to love their own wives as their own bodies. He who loves his own wife loves himself. For no one ever hated his own flesh, but nourishes and cherishes it, just as Christ also does the church, because we are members of his body. There's this idea of a care and a value for that person. So your spouse shouldn't withhold this type of relationship from you. But you should also be mindful of them and their feelings. That's a part of this relationship, having a caring love for that person, a value or a concern for them. You are together. This is an intimate relationship. And I don't just mean in the sexual act. I'm talking about the idea of you share together. You spend your lives together. You are companions. And so you should value that person. You should want to treat that person with respect. You should have care or concern for that person. And we could come up with a number of reasons why, legitimate reasons why you wouldn't enter into that type of relationship in a specific time or place. But it's understood that you have a husband to his wife and his wife to the husband. You have a care and concern for that person so that if they tell you no, you know it's for a good reason. You don't just demand it. This isn't a transactional relationship. And I think so often people look at it as a transactional relationship when you get really down to what the scriptures teach. We need to be careful about that. It's not meant to be that way, that it's just demanded or it's done on command. We have a care and concern. Yes, sir.
You could find
how I'm using it is I can demand it at any time. When I say transactional, and so it's my definition of the word. But my view of this is a husband can say, I want it and I want it now. There's no emotion. There's no feeling. I can demand it at any time. It is not governed by caring love. So when I say transactional, it is just a service you're providing me. Because it is transactional, but in a different sense, is what I think you're getting at. Okay. Okay, no, that's not a problem. If you have a question, that's my word, but that is not what it should be. It's not like you're just going to go to the checkout and get something. I'm just going to go pay for it and get it done. Or I just think of it in a very emotionless, demand it at any time, get it when I want sort of way. There's feelings involved. There's relationships that govern this. Yes, Craig. So the affection due her, not duty, right?
Right.
Okay.
It's not really the greatest translation, in my opinion, but I think it's trying to capture that it's not just like a sexual duty. You know, like, because we think duty is something that's owed, but at the same time, we think that it's like a win.
Mm hmm. Okay. Okay, so did you hear that, Craig? Okay, and that's good to understand. So it's often that you want to compare versions to see how they were translated. The King James Version was transcribed based on different manuscripts than the New American Standard. Both are good translations, so it's good that we compare versions. Quickly, before we move on, I'd never do anything quickly, it seems like. This idea of a sexual relationship, we're not going to go way into the family study or the relationship between a husband and wife, but it needs to be understood that the relationship between a husband and wife, this especially sex, begins to become, in our day and age, something that is flippant. That is something that we do because it's okay. We do it outside of the marriage relationship. And it's become very commonplace. And I feel like it's been tainted in a way. I'll think of the word I'm looking for in a second. But, it's not meant to be commonplace. It's supposed to be within a husband and wife. And so because it becomes so common, people don't hold value in that type of relationship, that sexual relationship. It is become, my vocabulary is escaping me. I think about the husband and wife relationship. This would be a better way to come at this. When you get married, it is not just gaining a companion in life. You're gaining a best friend if you do this right. It's somebody that hopefully you have love and affection for. Now, when we talk about the three different types of love, and again, I'm going to go way out there, but we talked about the three different types of love in a marriage relationship. You have caring love we've been talking about that is governed by your neighbor-to-neighbor relationship and that is commanded. The sexual relationship is one that is commanded in the husband-wife relationship we're talking about here. There's also this idea of affectionate love, that idea of joy and delight in a person. You can go to Jacob's relationships with his two wives and see that one relationship had affection, one didn't. Both of them were lawful marriages. But ideally, when you get married, you have this affectionate love in that relationship. When you when you enter into a sexual relationship outside the confines of marriage, not only is it unlawful, but you are dispelling or discouraging or disparaging your mates. You're disgracing the love that you have for them. You know, it's intimacy as much as anything else. If you're going to spend the rest of your life with a person, you're going to build a life together. You're going to share your deepest, darkest secrets. You're going to share yourself wholly and completely to them. Now, when you go outside of that relationship, you ruin the intimacy or you taint it. I think about the idea of when you go to get married to somebody, if you've held yourself holy and pure until you get married and that other person hasn't, it doesn't mean that they are trash. But wouldn't you want somebody to value you so much so that they would hold themselves pure for the time that they find somebody that they love, that they want to spend the rest of their life with? And then if you are cheated on, if somebody commits adultery on you once you're in that marriage relationship, how does that make you feel? You have the right to get out of that relationship, but it makes you feel like trash. It feels like you've been degraded, and it's been tossed aside. And so this idea of this sexual relationship has really been, it's just been destroyed in our country. That it's just going to become so commonplace that it's okay to do, because that's not the way it was intended. And in the marriage relationship, it is a holy and glorious thing, one that can be enjoyed. In fact, going to Proverbs, I think it's Proverbs 5. Yes, Proverbs 5, 15 through 21. It talks about the enjoyment that relationship can bring and how that relationship can satisfy you. Okay, it is an intimacy thing as much as anything else. When we say intimate love, it is more than just a sexual relationship. And so here, back in 1 Corinthians, I don't want what Paul is writing, because he has written so much and we have so much other to glean from, to view this as something that is, it's owed to me, give it to me, because there are other relationships that govern this type of act. Now, before I move on, I'll ask for comments or questions. Yes, Josh.
Response to that is 1 Corinthians 7, 1 and 2. Good for men not to touch a woman, but for immoralities, each man is to have his own wife. That's where that's fulfilled, is in having a wife. So if you don't have a wife, not supposed to be touching a woman.
I completely agree. There are thoughts that it's okay to do it outside of marriage. There's thoughts where it is just for procreation. And so I wanted to express and emphasize that this morning, that this relationship, though it talks about it very plainly in the idea of duty based on the relationship you sustain to that person, that it's more than just that. It's just the problem that they were having. We see that this problem that they're having stems from maybe this immorality that's been in the congregation. You go over to verse 26, we understand that there's a present distress going on. So we may not know why this is going on, but we do understand that it is a problem amongst the Corinthian brethren. And so Paul is addressing it. That being said, moving down, he says in verse 6, "But this I say by way of concession, not of command. Yet I wish that all men were even as I myself am. However, each man has his own gift from God, one in this manner and another in that." So Paul, he does it several times in the context, says that he wishes that all men were even as he is himself, which he was single. He didn't have this type of relationship. You can go down to in the latter part, I didn't mark it beforehand, but in the latter part of this chapter, he talks about being able to wholly devote yourself to God without this relationship. So now he's saying that your wife is a distraction. Not really. But the idea here is especially with what's going on, you can wholly devote yourself to God, and any distraction that you put forward, not that it's an ungodly one, but you know, especially with what they're dealing with, you can abstain from that. And I bring that up only to say, again, we have control over ourselves. So you don't have to be in that relationship. You don't have to have that sexual relationship with somebody. We have control over ourselves. But it is an avenue, if that is something that we deal with, to have as an outlet. So he says in verse 8, "But I say to the unmarried and to the widows that it is good for them if they remain even as I am." We're going to see from 8 on through 40 this common thread of remain. All right, so going from here on through the end of the chapter, this idea of remain. And we're going to deal with it in the standpoint of what they're dealing with and maybe the relationships they've come into based on or come out of. They've come out of this ungodly life into a godly life. And now we're going to have these relationships or situations that they need to deal with because of that. So, again, I'll read verse 8. "But I say to the unmarried and to widows that it is good for them to remain even as I. But if they do not have self-control, let them marry, for it is better to marry than to burn with passion." Now, moving on to verse 10, it says, "But to the married I give instructions, not I, but the Lord, that the wife should not leave her husband. But if she does leave, she must remain unmarried or else be reconciled to her husband, and that the husband should not divorce his wife." Does this context allow for divorce, condone divorce, as long as you don't get remarried? No. All right. Why? Okay. Yes, ma'am. And I completely agree, Christina. That this idea here is we interpret the clear, the unclear by the clear. One thing is God says do not divorce. But like Christina said, man is not perfect. Man is a sinful being and is disobedient. And there are situations that they're going to have to deal with. Galatians 6:1. Says, brethren, if anyone is caught in any trespass, you who are spiritual, restore such a one in a spirit of gentleness. This idea of being caught in a trespass, you know, people are gonna slip and fall. They're gonna have issues. You're gonna have sin in your life. Some things that happen, you can, I guess, walk back, but you're gonna have to face the consequences of your actions. And one of the consequences of this would be is if you tell your spouse to leave, if you divorce them, you make that mistake, you cause them to leave, those sort of things. What do you do? Now you're in a situation where it's not the right one. You need to be reconciled, but you can't force them to come back. So what do you do? And so this is what Paul is dealing with. You should not leave. It says should not leave her husband, but if she does leave, she must remain unmarried. So she leaves. And it's interesting here as you go through. Look at 11, the idea of divorce. At the beginning of that, it says leave. So 11, but if she does leave, and then it uses the word divorce. Divorce again in verse 12. Verse 13, it says she must not send her husband away. Synonymous with divorce. And then verse 15, yet if the unbelieving one leaves, let him leave. Synonymous with divorce. Helps us to define this word divorce. And so it's not just going down to the courthouse. It's severance of a relationship. And that may be that you tell somebody to go. That may be that they choose to leave and sever that relationship. And you may live under the same roof. But the idea is they've severed that type of relationship with you. But that's what they're dealing with here. If she does leave, she is decided to leave that husband for whatever reason, not scriptural. Okay, what does she do? Now she realizes she's made a mistake. She must remain unmarried or else be reconciled to that husband. Does that husband have to reconcile? No, he doesn't. But it says that husband should not divorce his wife. So they're dealing with that context here. I just want to point that out, that is not condoning divorce. That's not what it's. We interpret the unclear by the clear. And so we're dealing with what happens if a situation arises such as that. Questions, thoughts, or comments? Yes, ma'am. Mm-hmm.
And then be thoughtful when you're going and choosing a mate, because it may not turn out the way you
said. It may not. So 10 through 11, you see nowhere in there it talks about unbelievers. So I take that to mean these are two who are of Christ. Now we're dealing with a situation where first century Corinth, a lot of ungodliness going on. You've got those who come out of idolatry, who've come out of this worldly lifestyle. There's this present distress, whether it be persecution or something else. And so what happens if you are of God and you choose to leave your spouse? Let's deal with that issue. Now, let's move down to like what Don was saying. Let's move down to verse 12. It says, but to the rest I say, not the Lord, that if any brother has a wife who is an unbeliever and she consents to live with him, he must divorce her. Now, here you go. This is 5 or so years after Paul has come to Corinth and established a church there. What do I do? I have, like what Don was saying, I have married somebody who doesn't hold the same values or beliefs that I do. In fact, when I married them, I probably did. But I've changed. Okay, but what do I do with them? They're an unbeliever and they may drag me down. Their lifestyle may be different than mine. So do I just get rid of them? Does that relationship that I chose with God absolve me of the relationship I have with that spouse? Yes, Christina. Okay, so based on my study, and I will also defer to the others of the congregation who have studied this as well, but I would take it more as a new revelation. We know that Jesus spoke on marriage and that you are not to divorce. Now, here Paul is saying to the rest, I say not the Lord. He is still an apostle. He is still inspired by God. So it is a lawful command to them, or lawful, it's inspiration, but as far as I know, Jesus has not revealed that up until now. Yes, ma'am.
So then it sounds more like that he is using the logic that God has given all of us to make these valid conclusions.
Well, he is inspired by God. So I would say that this is inspiration. So, I mean, is it logical? Yes. But is it inspired by God giving him the, you know, he writes inspired, or he orates, he speaks. You know, I would say that. Yes, sir. So if you got in here, that the idea is that Jesus dealt with generalities. When you tell about Matthew 5 and Matthew 19, he dealt with divorce. He dealt with marriage in a general sense. Paul is dealing with a specific instance that's been written to him. And so it is not that. Is it logical? Yes, Christina, I do believe it is completely logical, but I'm not going to say this is of Paul's own thinking or doing. He is inspired by God. He's filled with the Holy Spirit. And this is what he wrote as inspiration. So it's not of the Lord, not the Lord, because it hasn't been revealed. He's dealing with a specific situation. So it's still something we should deal with, or we should view as inspiration. It's just not something that had been revealed to this point that we know of to us. Yes, ma'am.
And then another comment or a thought that I kind of have is going back to when it was said earlier that we have the right to divorce, but it, like you said, we have to deal with the consequences. We know that God hates divorce, so it's really not a right.
I don't see where it says it's a right. It's just dealing with if they did. Okay, no, I'll clarify, because if I said it, you only have the right to divorce if your spouse has committed adultery. Okay, so that is the only time you have the right to divorce.
I guess I disagree with that, because it says that you're not supposed to divorce. Earlier, God said he hates divorce.
Mm-hmm.
Jesus said that you're not supposed to leave your spouse, even though he did say, except for under fornication, you cause her to sin. But then, if you're divorcing your spouse, are you not giving them an earthly punishment, which goes against
Does forgiveness equate to absolution of punishment? So that's how I would deal with that. My spouse, Melissa, better not. But if Melissa ever cheated on me, okay, I have a responsibility to forgive her. I have no responsibility to take her back. And whatever punishment that comes with that, both earthly or spiritual, because it's not my determination whether she gets to heaven. It's whether she's penitent and she lives a godly life after that. So if somebody goes and kills one of my kids, I should, and it'd be very difficult. No, nobody said this life is easy, but I should forgive that person. Okay? Only if they're repentant. Sorry. But that does not mean that they don't have to face the consequences of their action. Okay, so you said if she comes back,
yes.
I have to accept her back. If she chose to leave, she severed the relationship. You can't enter into a relationship one-sided. She can't come back and say, well, I'm here. You agreed to join into that relationship, and you must agree to come back to that relationship. So she chooses to come back to me. I have to choose to accept her back. She has severed the relationship, and then only to enter into that relationship again, you must choose to do it together. Once I accept her back, then we're in that relationship again. Otherwise, I can put her out, and that's what God has given me authority to do. No. If she severed, I can be ignorant of the entire situation. She walks out the door, whether she's committed adultery or not. If she severs the relationship with me, I have no recourse. I can't get remarried. She severed the relationship. I didn't. It's told to us in Matthew 5 and Matthew 19 that I can put them away for the reason of adultery. But if I didn't put her away, she put me away, then I'm stuck in a situation where I didn't sever the relationship. I have no right to be remarried. Now that's a whole nother topic. Like there's a whole nother to it. Okay, so yes, ma'am. So we can come back to that. I don't have a problem with coming back to that and dealing with that. But that is when we talk about, it's good to define terms, marriage, divorce. It's good to define those terms and what those mean, because that's what we're getting into now. What does it mean to, in the Bible, versus what does it mean to us? And so. All right. Last thing, if Michael oblige me for a second. Here it talks about in 12:3-16, the idea of an unbelieving husband or wife. You're not to send them away. If you find yourself in that relationship, you are converted, you're in that relationship, you're not to put them away. You becoming a Christian does not absolve you of your responsibility or your relationship. Josh dealt with that in his class. Okay, so just because I became a Christian doesn't mean I just do away with everything else, gives me the right to remarry. I still have that relationship I sustain to that person. I'm not to divorce. Divorce is only for the reason of adultery. And so be careful who you choose as a mate, because you may marry somebody and you may love them and you can have a good life with them. But that does not mean that if you get done with them, you can just discard them. They may never become a Christian. And so be careful who you choose. Doesn't mean you can't marry somebody who's an unbeliever, but are they going to help you get to heaven? Or are they going to drag you down? And you are to live with that person. There's no outs. It's an important life lesson. All right. Sorry, Michael. Thank you.